Welcome back to another episode of The Damage Report. I'm John Iadarola, very excited to have not only a new in-studio co-host for today's episode, but also two co-hosts. We have Anna Kasparian.
Hey.
Welcome back. We
Thank
get you,
you
once a quarter and we're always happy to have you. I'm kidding. And for the first time ever, Michael Brooks of the
Yay!
Michael Brooks Show.
It's great to be here,
How's
guys.
How's it going? Good to have you here.
Awesome to be here.
You're in LA for about a week.
I am gonna be leaving for the airport basically after this.
Oh, really?
So like this is my last leg.
Awesome, so you came here to do a live show mm-hmm. and you have already been seduced by LA.
I've been slowly, every time I come out here, usually mm-hmm. the first like 2 or 3 days, I'm like, this is so nice, mm-hmm. I wanna move here. And then after 4 or 5 days, I'm like, no, this is dead. I need to get out of here. And this is the first time that I'm like, man, this is really nice. This is like, just like indulge my inner hippie.
Go to a farmer's market.
Go to the farmer's market. Yeah. Sweet lemons.
No, nice. Mm-hmm.
See, like,
peaches that taste like marshmallows. It's
you are
weird.
Legitimate. I get why people are so zoned out here.
Mm-hmm. Zoned out. Yeah. It's true. It is true.
I want to be. I want to get some of that zone out.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's healthy. Yeah. You know, you need a little bit of it in your life. That's some people are a little too zoned out, though. For
maybe
sure.
a little bit.
Yeah.
We did a live show and Anna crushed it.
Thank you.
Awesome.
Thank you so
you
much crushed
again.
It. It was so much fun.
That was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And for those who came, Waz is fine.
Yeah, Waz was great. He was having a good time.
Waz was having a very
drunk.
Good time. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
My comrade Waz, who's one of our fellow guests, was like blitz, but he did an amazing job.
Awesome.
I was happy you got blitzed.
That sounds fun. That's cool. And we're very glad to have you here. We got a lot that we're going to be talking about through the course of this hour. We're going to be starting off, obviously, Joe Biden is now in the primary, justifying being in all those polls this whole time. So we're going to be talking about that. Also, Pete Buttigieg doesn't think that Bernie could beat Trump in the general election. We'll see what our panel thinks about that statement. Really bad news coming out of Afghanistan in terms of civilian deaths there. We'll be talking about that. Trump administration wants to send migrant kids to Guantanamo Bay because of course they do. David K. Johnson will be joining us to break down a little bit of where the Democrats go from what we know from the Mueller report. And Newsweek with a job posting that pissed me off. And so we'll be ending the show with that if we have time. But starting off with the big domestic news story of the day. Joe Biden is now in the race. He is running and he released a video to go along with this. Take a look at a section of his announcement.
I believe history will look back on 4 years of this president and all he embraces as an aberrant moment in time. But if we give Donald Trump 8 years in the White House, he will forever and fundamentally alter the character of this nation, who we are. And I cannot stand by and watch that happen. The core values of this nation, our standing in the world, our very democracy, everything that has made America, America is at stake. That's why today I'm announcing my candidacy for President of the United States. Folks, America's an idea that's stronger than any army, bigger than any ocean, more powerful than any dictator or tyrant. It gives hope to the most desperate people on earth. It guarantees that everyone is treated with dignity and gives hate no safe harbor. It instills in every person in this country the belief that no matter where you start in life, there's nothing you can't achieve if you work at it. That's what we believe. And above all else, that's what's at stake in this election. We can't forget what happened in Charlottesville. Even more important, we have to remember who we are. This is America.
Okay. So he's running.
Yeah.
I think my first shallow impression of that ad is I think that regular voters who aren't 100% politically savvy will find that to be appealing.
Right.
Yes. It looks like it could have been written either for a Democrat or for a Republican. There wasn't a lot of like policy mentioned in it. It was kind of just, you know, lofty language about American values and all that. What do you guys think? Putting that in the context of who else he's going to be running against.
Well, let me just start off by saying that I wish I were one of the people who would watch that video and feel inspired and believe the things that he's saying. But unfortunately, I know too much and I'm more of a cynic and I'm super pessimistic about what America really is, mm-hmm. what it has been, and what Donald Trump has done in that he's not the catalyst. I tweeted about this. He's not the catalyst for the lack of character that we're seeing among his supporters, right? Now, among yes. Republicans, his approval rating's very high, it's in the 90s. And what he's done is basically destroyed the facade of Republican morality or the idea that the right wing ever had any character. What he did is emboldened the right wing to reveal what their character really is. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the issues I had with this whole statement. Like, this whole whitewashing of what America is and how there's no place for hate in this country. What are you talking about? This country was built on devastating people, built on destroying people's lives and disenfranchising some while, you know, raising others. And I have an issue with the whole message. And of course, he's running against Trump. Like, that's already out of the gate what his campaign is about.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think that that's a smart strategy.
I think that, you know, if we simplified all of the arguments between progressive or centrist or whatever, in some ways it's like, we all recognize that we need to defeat Trump and that Trump is an emergency, but do we want to defeat the context that led to Trump? Mm-hmm. And then there's even different degrees of addressing the context. Obviously, I think Bernie's the most structural and fundamental. I think Warren gets to it in some ways. Bernie, you know, obviously my preferred candidate. Biden is running the pure, it's just Trump. Mm-hmm. Like, history stopped in 2016. Besides that, basically everything was cool. And we need to go back to that. I think what's going to be tricky is I think there is the biggest disconnect of any candidate between what people like us think of him and what mm-hmm. his appeal is. We loathe the guy for every imaginable substantive reason. Anita Hill, Iraq, credit card bill, segregation mm-hmm. policies, if you go back to the 70s. But I think he does have a certain type of charisma and he does have a certain type of appeal. And he's going to speak to a certain type of person that is looking for and craves normalcy in a certain way. And then the other tricky dynamic is, how do you calibrate? I think people do need to be really smart and attentive in how they speak about President Obama. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, him coming forward, like, some people want to hit him on everything up until the 8 years that he worked for President Obama. So the other challenge of him is, are people going to be real about the Obama record on Wall Street and drones and things like that? Because that's part of this structure versus just get rid of Trump conversation. And he really distills it.
Yeah, I'm glad that you brought up the Obama, because I got to think about that in just a second. But I saw someone refer to him as, he's the candidate that believes that Trump is the cause, not a symptom, basically.
Yes. Right,
like, there's been this argument that it's the opposite. I'm a little bit more nuanced on that. I think that he is sort of the natural, like, what our economy and what, you know, all of our political conversation has created out there brings about a candidate like him. But I do think that once he's in office, he does embolden, you know, extremist groups and things like that. But I think that he's primarily a symptom of more structural issues. So he's not going to be running to change the system or anything like that. My concern is that there was an argument before the 2016 election or during it that if we reject Hillary Clinton, then people will demand a fundamentally different candidate. And there was a chance that could work. It might happen. But I also have a fear. It's not a big fear. It's not a greater than 50% fear. It's just a fear that I think people just want something better than what they've got. Mm-hmm. And if you give them a monster, normalcy going back to a centrist, that's a lot better than what we've got. That's my fear. I don't think that that's going to win. But Biden, he just looks like, oh, it's no more sending kids to Guantanamo, you know, no more family separation or whatever. And he could slide by just on, not on anything he brings, but what he doesn't bring. And what he doesn't bring is Donald Trump.
So I've made this argument in regard to Buttigieg, and I think it certainly applies with Biden as well. Normalcy, yes, but more importantly, for the people on the left and maybe some independents who are disgusted by the Trump presidency, they're likely going to be attracted to certain candidates that speak to their nostalgia, mm-hmm. right? So for most people who aren't hyper aware of the flaws in the Obama administration, who didn't cover it and talk about it on a regular basis, on the surface, everything seemed fine, right? And so Biden represents that. And the reason why I include Buttigieg in that argument is because Buttigieg is very Obama-esque. All of the things that appeal to voters about Obama, appeal to voters about Buttigieg, He went to Harvard. He's so smart. He's well-spoken. You know, I'm talking about people who don't dig a little deeper and look into some of the policies that he spearheaded in South Bend that really hurt some minority communities, particularly black people living in that area. But on the surface, again, it's all about surface politics. Buttigieg and I think Biden represent the nostalgia that some Democrats are looking for.
Buttigieg is trash, and I look forward to trashing him soon. But I think I think you're totally right. But I think that I think some, you know, part of this that people you're pointing to that people don't really like to acknowledge, particularly those of us who are really policy oriented, is that a lot of the stuff is actually personality driven, obviously, and it is about a certain type of appeal. And what's interesting to me is I actually think Buttigieg and Biden are kind of the inverse. I think Biden is a guy who, if you're in a certain sector, particularly if you're like, you know, in media or active on Twitter or whatever, like some type of millennial adjacent to the Democratic Party, you're not gonna like that guy. Mm-hmm. And his version of being like an old Irish whatever is not gonna appeal to you. Mm-hmm. But it's gonna appeal to a lot of normal primary voters. I think Buttigieg actually is tailor-made for like neurotic Ivy League obsessives and not for normal people in the same way. That's actually a huge advantage Bernie has. The funny secret about Bernie is that he's a super effective politician outside of the, you know, sure, he's sloppy and he's grouchy or whatever, but he's a clear, relentless communicator.
That's true.
And you know exactly what he's saying, and it's simple and it's distilled, and it actually works in a very simple, clear way.
And it's consistent.
And it's consistent.
And I think that that sincerity and that authenticity does speak to many voters. In fact, believe it or not, a conservative who writes for the National Review, Rich Lowry, made that same point following his town hall on Fox News.
Yeah.
And so I think that, you know, right now, Biden and Bernie are kind of head to head in the polls. It really depends on which poll you're looking at. But it is interesting to see this, you know, divide. I don't know if it's a divide, but there's definitely more of a reception toward Bernie this time around, and that makes me hopeful. I don't know how this is gonna change with Biden announcing.
Yeah, I mean, Biden, he does have some appeal to some people we might not have expected for a Democratic candidate. Like, he's gonna be in his first big interview is gonna be on The View, and there's a 25% chance Meghan McCain hugs him. Like on the show, honestly.
Yeah,
so
that
should help him in the primary, I'm sure, having Meghan McCain's support.
Oh, yeah. Everyone wants to know.
Exactly. I'm joking. Yes, of course. So we do have to go to our first break. I will say that just 12 minutes into the show, I really wish sometimes the Damage Report was a 2-hour show, but unfortunately, we are constrained by the linear format. So we're going to take a break. When we come back, Pete Buttigieg, another shot at Bernie.
Boo.
Buttigieg. Boo. After this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today, and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
So we are back, Anna Kasparian, Michael Brooks, and myself. And now we turn to another of the contenders in the Democratic primary, Pete Buttigieg. either he's really about talking about Bernie or he's just getting asked about Bernie a lot. But two times in the last week or so, he's seemingly attacked Bernie. So we're going to break down the most recent one now. In an interview, Buttigieg said Mr. Sanders' left-wing proposals were no longer as provocative as in 2016. Quote, people were refreshed by the novelty of that boldness and expressed skepticism that a self-described democratic socialist in his late 70s could win a general election. I think he's in his mid-70s. Quote, I have a hard time seeing the coalition ultimately coming together there.
Well, I mean, he's polling pretty well, so what? And he also has specific policy proposals that he's been advocating for literally for decades. And what does Buttigieg bring to the table other than a lot of poetic, you know, talk? And honestly, he brings nothing to the table. There's nothing specific. What would you do? And he thinks that there's something wrong with running for president and revealing to the voters what you would do and how you would do it. It's hilarious because, look, the mainstream media is constantly playing this disingenuous game of how are you gonna pay for it with Bernie and Elizabeth Warren, right?
Right.
Now, they've explained how they're gonna pay for their policies over and over again, but the mainstream media doesn't care. When it comes to Buttigieg, he doesn't wanna reveal what his actual policies are, where his stances are, and for some reason, he is better than all these other candidates in the eyes of you know, mainstream media political pundits.
Because they're obsessed with this nonsense, like their version of superficiality, which is you speak six different languages, right? Like I don't care. I care about somebody's savvy and their intelligence in the sense of their like capacity to, you know, understand how things work, understand power, and have a clear value set. I don't care what their degree is in or how many languages they speak. I just don't. And if anything, that could potentially be undermining of a certain kind of leadership. But I think that what strikes me about that comment is, one, I think even people like on our side of the equation are talking about who can win way too early. There's a dynamic in which there's only like, okay, Amy Klobuchar probably is not gonna win anything, right? But there's a scenario in which like Trump is really unpopular at the moment. He's vulnerable to all of them. That dynamic could change in several months and he could be much stronger against any of them. That being said, what is mind blowing to me is if you just took it in a super narrow electoral college framework, where Bernie is strong and overperforms is in the map that you need to win to win the race. He's gonna overperform in the industrial Midwest. He's gonna speak to exactly those types of concern sets amongst the working class of all racial backgrounds. So actually a candidate like Buttigieg to me is more dangerous, and not just because of people's homophobia, which will be an issue that people need to be real about, and of course we should fight against that, but also because this sort of like weird, like 2019 Thomas Friedman thing he's doing is appealing to, like, what is he gonna do? Like drive up the margin in Westchester? I don't think this is gonna bring out somebody in Wisconsin who's jobless.
You know, it's interesting because he has been talking about Bernie a lot. Like he had the thing last week, which we criticized on the show a little bit less for attacking Bernie and more for it sort of ignoring the some of the cultural reasons that Donald Trump ended up in the White House, about how wanting to blow up the system means you could support Bernie or Trump. I guess you flip a coin, you support one of the two or whatever. But he's been targeting Bernie. I wonder if he's going to quickly turn his criticisms against Biden, because I have a feeling that in terms of competition over voters, there's some weird stuff in the polls where like Biden voters' second choice is Bernie, Bernie's voters' second choice is Biden, which doesn't make any sense to me, but it exists. We'll have to see how that shakes out. But I have a feeling that the Buttigieg is gonna be competing for the Biden voters much more than the Bernie voters. So I think he's gonna have to change his rhetoric in that regard. And in terms of, you were talking about the competition for like the Rust Belt, Industrial Midwest, all of that, Biden has this aura of that's who he is. He appeals to those people. And I would love to see the empirical basis for that statement. I mean, I've heard about it for years and years. We've seen him run for president a couple of times. Whatever that strength was supposed to bring, it didn't manifest in the previous times he tried to become president. Dave Weigel had a great tweet breaking down in 2008 where his support was coming from, and it was from non-union households with income between 75 and 125K or something like that. Like it was not, and anyway, so Biden is gonna run up against that aura, I think will be undercut by Bernie's actual popularity in that group. And then Buttigieg has a lot of the sort of, you know, getting things back to the way they were appeal that Biden would, except He also speaks Norwegian and plays the Zephyr,
right,
or whatever. So
yeah, and I actually want to comment on what those on the left really like about Buttigieg and what I think people in the middle of the country are going to hate about him. And it is that notion that he comes from this elitist class, right? And just think about some of the biggest criticisms that you heard toward the left in 2016. They're elitist. They don't care about us. They left us behind. The economy only improved for certain people who can contribute to the stock market. I mean, you heard that over and over again. Buttigieg, because of the fact that we keep talking about his fancy Ivy League education, I think represents that and feeds into that argument.
Totally.
And so what I think Bernie does really well, and I honestly thought it would be impossible, is that he speaks to the issues that unite all of us regardless of political ideology. And it has to do with economic frustration, right? The economic frustrations are felt by everyone in the middle class and the working class. And remember, when Trump ran his campaign, it was this like fake populist campaign, exactly, where he's gonna look out for those blue collared workers who have been left behind. And so I think Buttigieg is really underestimating the power of Bernie Sanders' message, and I think that he's overestimating his fancy Ivy League education.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's 100% right. And I think that, you know, it leads to, like at the CNN town hall, what are you going to do about student debt? Well, college is great, and here's a convoluted proposal. And it's like, how about free college and student loan cancellation?
Yeah.
Done.
Yeah, I would like, love to I see Elizabeth Warren's plan spread throughout.
I gave you a 10-second answer.
Yeah.
And I think that there, simplicity is actually a virtue. Like, people confuse simplicity. Like, there's dumbing things down is one thing, but simplicity is a good thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
The only other point I want to make on Buttigieg is you mentioned the likelihood that although there's seemingly less homophobia than there was, it's still a big deal. So far as I know, Donald Trump, like he announced he when Biden announced, he was like, you know, welcome to the race, Sleepy Joe or whatever. It doesn't even take Buttigieg becoming the candidate. It'll happen in the primary. But if Buttigieg was the candidate, this is no reason not to support him. But can you imagine how disgusting the homophobia from Donald Trump and his surrogates is going to be?
Of course I can imagine.
Yeah.
Like, of course I can.
I'm trying to.
I can almost pre-tweet it. I have a mind meld with Donald
Trump.
I get it. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, totally.
Nobody hates Donald Trump more than me, but
he goes. It's what's bizarre though is I feel like he doesn't. I mean, policy wise, he does, but he does not have the same fixation with gay people that he does for women or black people or Muslims or so. But of course he will.
But
no doubt.
He hasn't been targeted by a prominent gay person. I think he's willing to use whatever is there in the person to attack them. But maybe we'll see.
Definitely. We don't have to wait
it's
to
get
see.
Dark.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that.
Okay, we do have to take another break. When we come back, bad news out of Afghanistan and also possibly out of Cuba after this.
Since you've been gone, when I met you, I was so in love.
I honestly can't remember the last time that there was anything I would classify as good news out of Afghanistan, but we've got a new flavor of bad news, and it has to do with civilian casualties there, where for the first time, the Afghan and US governments are actually responsible for the majority of civilian deaths in Afghanistan. This is according to the United Nations in a quarterly report. Pro-government forces were responsible for 53% of civilian deaths. Insurgents were responsible for the majority of civilian casualties overall, but in terms of deaths, it was actually us. We're looking at 581 civilians killed, almost 1,200 wounded during the first quarter, a 23% decrease in overall casualties compared with the same period in 2018, which is a small silver lining, I guess, but you're still talking about literally hundreds of people being killed and over 1,000 being injured. They're killed in a number of different ways. I believe suicide bombers is the most likely way. That's the number one. Number two, I think, is IEDs. And aerial operations were the third, killing 145 civilians, a 41% increase from the same quarter in 2018. Yeah.
I think it's important to, this isn't the kind of story that goes viral. This isn't the kind of story that Americans are talking about, unfortunately. But this is the type of story that helps us understand how our actions abroad lead to the type of, you know, terrorist organizations like ISIS, and how they are able to recruit people, right? Like, people don't hate America because we're great, Like, there aren't people abroad who are looking at America thinking, I am so jealous of how great America is, I'm gonna go ahead and plot a terrorist attack against them. Yeah. No, it happens as a direct result of what we have done for decades abroad, right? Our foreign policy has consequences. I'm not saying that to justify the hostilities or the action against the United States or the Western world. I'm not saying to justify terrorist attacks. Please don't misunderstand me in that regard. But what I'm saying is, everything you do has a consequence, either a positive or a negative. And our foreign policy and our, you know, preemptive wars and our interventions and what we're doing in Yemen right now with the Saudi-led coalition, it has consequences. And I wish Americans were more aware of what we're doing and how we need to actually step in and elect leaders who think that this kind of activity is disgusting.
And also take on, you know, there's so many structural variables behind these, why these things don't get wound down, right? And so, like, we've been in Afghanistan since either late 2001 or 2002, right?
Yeah.
So that's longer than Vietnam, it's longer than World War II. And there's all these interlocking systems. There's like the relationship with the Pakistanis and the double game that we both play with each other. We exploit Pakistan incredibly in order to fuel our jets and have, you know, access to Afghanistan. We've killed plenty of people with drones. And then the Pakistanis take money from us, but then also fund groups that are attacking us. And you have this whole thing that needs to, like, these self-licking ice cream cones, basically. And, like, in the middle of it, you just kill, like, a tremendous amount of people.
Yeah.
And I think you're absolutely right. Like, you can go to a place like, you know, you go to the Middle East and they'll say, like, the 1953 coup in Iran against Mossadegh is, like, a life-defining thing for Iranians. Most Americans have no clue that that would have even, like, they don't even know the beginnings of what they don't know. And so, yeah, the like rapper response is like, oh, they hate us because of our shine. It's actually like, no, they're hating us because we've killed a tremendous amount of people. And we also, you know, back all sorts of regimes and so on. And I think like that is another dimension of the presidential race that's really important.
That
you need to connect an understanding of what's happening here with, you know, obviously I talk a lot about the reversal of progress in Latin America and the Caribbean. And I think that even also though the distinction between just being anti-interventionist, what some candidates say they are, versus a really broad understanding of how global oligarchy works and what actually drives these policies.
I want to return to that in one sec, actually, because I was just thinking about that. But really fast, I want to focus for a second on the 145 civilians killed by the aerial operations. And the reason is that there's lots of ways that people have died, but that's the one that's us.
Yep.
Entirely, like, you know. And so imagine, I just think, like, I remember 9/11. I was in the second week of college. And I remember the campus conversation around it and all that. And I remember watching a little bit in the news. I didn't really follow politics all that much at that point. But imagine if you'd told someone in 18 years, in the first quarter of that year, we're gonna kill 145 civilians just by airstrikes just in Afghanistan.
Right.
Nobody would have believed you. Nobody would have thought that that's possible. 18 years that literally people who haven't been born yet will be in bombers dropping bombs at that point.
And that the whole set of US foreign policy is gonna change and it's actually going to cumulatively kill or displace millions of people if you include all of that.
Yeah.
From Iraq to Afghanistan to all the drone operations and everywhere from Somalia to Yemen, not to mention torture.
Right. Yeah.
And Guantanamo and rendition.
Yes. And I just want to really fast mention, because you talked about the sort of understanding of the global oligarchy and what feeds these, what prolongs these conflicts and some of the groups and their actions and all that. This is one of the reasons why I know that Bernie recently said at a town hall, one of the mistakes he's made is not focusing enough on foreign policy in his speeches. And that's true, he doesn't generally talk about it very much. But over the last year, how much time and effort did he put into ending our involvement in the war in Yemen? Even though he got no positive press for it. I know, because nobody talks about it. I had Ro Khanna on like 5 times to talk about that effort over the last year. There was collectively 11,000 views across his videos. Nobody cares.
And that is a genocidal campaign.
Exactly, one of the worst situations in the world right now. But Bernie did it. He didn't talk a lot about it. He used his time, he accomplished that. And yes, Trump has briefly stopped that, but they're still fighting. And that's why I think he deserves far more credit in being anti-war than he gets, because yes, he doesn't talk about it very much, but his actions prove it.
He's also talking about restoring the Iran deal. He's also the only candidate to mention Lula. I mean, he is ahead of the curve, objectively.
Yeah,
the thing about Bernie is that he's not a boastful person. And so what you have to do when it comes to his foreign policy positions is look at his record and the way he's voted historically on a number of conflicts that unfortunately we've gotten involved in over and over again. You know, he has been against inflating and you know, blowing up the defense budget, because he knows where that money really goes and how that continues perpetuating, you know, this cycle of war. And I love that you mentioned, you know, the consequences when it came to torture, and that's very much a conversation that's coming up again now. There's a big story regarding a Navy SEAL who it's not torture, but he allegedly killed civilians, and I'm saying allegedly because I legally have to say allegedly, but it's a big case because on one hand you have the right wing who, because of these cycles and because of these wars, now completely justify, you know, killing civilians by members of the Navy SEAL, by members of our military, including this Navy SEAL. And so what does it do to our consciousness? What does it do to our ability to see others abroad as humans? Yeah. We have been dehumanizing them. And so I go back to the argument that no, they don't hate us simply because we're wonderful and we're fantastic and we have such a great way of life. They hate us because we're murdering their mothers, we're murdering their children. Right. You know, we're locking people up indefinitely in Guantanamo, we're torturing them. We have to really take a good hard look at ourselves and think about how we can reform the way we do things so it actually minimizes the instances of these attacks, these terrorist attacks.
Okay, we do have to take another break. When we come back, investigative reporter David K. Johnson is gonna be joining us to talk about the findings of the Mueller report, where the Democrats go from here, impeachment related issues after this. It's been almost a week since we got the Mueller report, and we now have a little bit of context on how people have interpreted its findings, what the Democrats appear to be doing strategically in the wake of it. And to talk about that and related issues, we are lucky enough to be joined now by investigative reporter and founder of DCReport.org, David K. Johnston. Welcome back to the Damage Report.
Glad to be here, John.
Always glad to have you here to talk about the important issues. So in past appearances on the show, we've made some like light predictions about what we thought might be in the Mueller report. Now that you've seen it, you've seen what's in it and also what's not in it, what are your thoughts?
Well, the important thing is that Bill Barr lied through his teeth about what's in this report, but because he got out there first, the news herd is going to go with a narrative that is now muddied. The report is very clear. There were repeated efforts by the Trump administration to work with the Russians, and the Russians were actively, and there's no dispute that about this point, actively trying to interfere with the American election. And not once did anybody on the Trump side do their duty. There is an astonishing observation in the report. You know the old adage, ignorance is no defense. Ignorance of the law is no defense. Well, Mueller argues that Don Jr. may have been too stupid to understand that when the Russian government through an emissary offered to help his father's campaign, that his duty was to pick up the phone, call the FBI, and ask to speak to someone in counterintelligence. But the report makes it clear that they tried and tried. Unfortunately, they were blocked by the destruction of evidence, the use of encrypted emails, the refusal of people to testify, etc. So there is more than enough here to say that gross improprieties took place. And while they may not meet the criminal standard of guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, that's not the constitutional standard for a president.
And so I want to turn to what I have long considered to be the most important part of this process, is the precedent that could be set if the president is able to, impede investigations. Because it's one thing, many people are not interested in whatever's going to be found in this, or they don't think that it's that significant, it's being overblown, all of that. But they might well want a future president to be investigated for a variety of different potential crimes or corruption. And to me, I read what's in there as the most clear examples of potential obstruction of justice imaginable. If it doesn't rise to that level, I don't know what that term is supposed to mean. And yet I still see people, obviously the Trump supporters are gonna interpret it their way, but I see people saying that it's sort of up for debate, or they're not really sure if it actually rises to the level of obstruction of justice. What do you make of that?
Well, unfortunately, the vast majority of Americans, like Donald Trump, have never read our Constitution and don't know what's in it. We will have a piece up later today, a DC report that goes through the law about this and explains to people the court decisions. Trump is relying in part on a court decision from the communist witch hunt days in the 50s, in believing that it is not legitimate for Congress to investigate him because the Democrats are in control of the House. That's absolute poppycock. And it is, in fact, been argued by former President Woodrow Wilson that the investigative function of Congress is more important than the legislative function of Congress in some cases. So what you're going to see now are a whole series of efforts to investigate. Congress has power here. In the past, Congress has arrested people, tried them, and incarcerated them for refusing to cooperate. I don't think the Democrats are going to go that far. It hasn't been done in more than a century. But they can fine people. There's been talk of $25,000 a day. And the first big test, I suspect, is going to come from Charles Rettig, the Beverly Hills lawyer to wealthy tax cheats who get caught, who is the IRS commissioner. He is the person charged under law with turning over Trump's tax returns. Steve Mnuchin, his supervisor, the Treasury Secretary, has said that they want until May 6 to get an opinion from the Justice Department on whether they have to turn them over. It shouldn't take more than 20 seconds to read the law, Section 6103, which says that upon written request, the IRS shall furnish documents to Congress, as it's been doing routinely and without a single break in the chain since that law took effect 95 years ago. And there is another provision in the law, 7214, that says that if Rettig fails to do this, he shall be removed from office. Of course, that would require integrity on the part of the Trump administration, and he can be prosecuted. But if Trump is voted out in 2020, Rettig could be arrested, indicted, prosecuted, and if convicted, I would expect he would go to prison and he would lose his law license. So a bunch of Trump people are soon going to face the prospect of cooperating with Congress or being willing to go to jail to protect Donald Trump from constitutional process.
Exactly. And it makes you wonder, we've talked about the taxes before, it makes you wonder what would be in there that would both lead Donald Trump to be willing to order his subordinates to not cooperate with these investigations and things like that, but also that someone would be willing to go to jail to make sure that it doesn't come out. I've seen that you've been talking a little bit on social media about the taxes recently. Right. What is your current working hypothesis for why exactly they're going to these lengths?
Well, to make clear, I'm the person who revealed in 1990 that Trump wasn't a billionaire. He called me a liar for months until he had to reveal a document showing he had a negative net worth of $295 million. And I got his 2005 tax return that showed he had bought an illegal tax shelter. It was made illegal within weeks of when he bought it, but Congress allowed those who'd already bought these tax shelters to keep their ill-got gains. The New York Times, where I used to work, in a definitive piece, stated as fact that Donald Trump is a tax cheat. And I can state that as fact because he had two tax fraud trials, civil trials, in the over his 1984 tax return. And he not only lost both of them, which are in my biography, The Making of Donald Trump, but he was excoriated by the judges and his own longtime tax lawyer and CPA, Jack Mitnick, testified against him at those trials. So first of all, Donald knows that a thorough audit will establish he's a tax cheat. And that's what happened to Richard Nixon when under Section 6103, Congress got his tax returns. It turned out Nixon had illegally taken a deduction worth in today's money almost $3.5 million. His tax lawyer went to jail. Nixon did not, only because he was pardoned by Gerry Ford. Mm. Secondly, the tax returns will put us on a path to seeing where money came from. There are plenty of transactions that Trump has done that I've written about, which make no economic sense with Russians and Saudis and Emiratis and others, but they make perfect sense if he's laundering money for them. And I think that just as it's very clear that Donald Trump was an unindicted cocaine trafficker in business with Joseph Wexelbaum and is the named individual one, but unindicted participant in some of the crimes for which his lawyer, Michael Cohen, is going to prison, that Donald Trump, we will find out with a thorough audit, was laundering money.
And we will have to wait to see if we ever get that thorough audit. But until then, David K. Johnson, always glad to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Here we're going to take one last break. We've got a little bit more time. Newsweek is looking for fellows to write articles for them, and we've got an issue with it after this. Newsweek online is apparently looking for people to write stories for them, and so they put out a job posting on that. And I saw it on Twitter, and I want to take a look at this and break down some information from there. I can't tell if you can actually read that, but the important part is that they're looking for fellows for full-time positions for a certain period of time, a few months. The important things you need to know are they want you to write 400-to-500-word stories per day after having tracked down trending viral topics that nobody is talking about, which seems like a little bit inconsistent there. This has to be the hottest thing imaginable and nobody's seen it. You're doing self-editing and all of that, and like you're crafting all of the SEO stuff to make sure that it's spread, and they're gonna pay you $15 an hour, which, hey, $15 an hour, right? Also, coincidentally, is the lowest amount that they're able to pay. If we bring up this, you're gonna see that as of November of last year, this next graphic, that's the lowest that they could possibly pay. Thank you to everyone who fought to get it up to $15 an hour, by the way. But they want these people to crank out the content for effectively minimum wage in New York now. And I saw that, and obviously, you know, I'm not a big fan of that they're replacing full-time paid writers who would get much more per word in the past with effectively people who are gonna be ground down by the machine. But it also makes me think how lucky I am, you know, however tangential my job is to actual journalism of this sort, that I have a company that backs me and that I'm not scrounging around just to pay rent. Like, think about people working their way up through the system now, how little their experience and their work is valued at. That they will, if they could pay less than 15, they would. Mm-hmm. If they could replace this with some sort of AI algorithm that puts together trending news hits or whatever, they would, and that might be coming.
Yeah, look, I'm glad that you're upset about this, but this is indicative of the news industry overall. The news industry is not a nonprofit career path. In fact, a lot of these organizations have boards, and these investors want to do what? They want to get a return on their investment. And how do you get a return on your investment? You screw the workers over. You pay them as little as possible. You find ways to get interns, in some cases unpaid interns to do the jobs of professionals. And it's gross. It's gross. And so I see that story, and of course it upsets me, but I can't say that I'm surprised.
Yeah, and this isn't even really about Newsweek. I'm sure that this is the one that we saw.
It's about Newsweek, John.
Yeah,
this is specifically about Newsweek, just to be clear.
Yeah.
No, I think obviously it's disgusting, and I think the flip side of it, and definitely not, you know, nobody should be getting paid this amount, period. But I've been talking with a lot of people recently in different, you know, sort of creative related fields, and which in some ways are relatively more privileged than, like, obviously if you're working in a coal mine or something. But the other manifestation of this is that you build these industries that are based on unpaid internships, these ridiculous wages, and then the only people that can do it come from capital, which then regenerates a culture of, as an example, like, Bernie's so angry, or, you know, my friends tell me that Bolsonaro's great, like we were at a rooftop together. And it reinforces the conditions of the mediocrity of the coverage and the sort of bland cultural consensus of people who like Buttigieg.
Yeah.
That's such a great point. Yeah, I mean, it definitely bleeds into the type of reporting and the type of commentary you see in the news industry.
Yeah, and also, I mean, it just screams from that news posting, you're gonna find viral stuff and you're gonna give it to us. And yeah, I'm sure you'd love to spend a day or 2 days or a week on something diving deep, substantive, policy related. We have no time for that. And we unfortunately don't have time to talk about it, but this happens to me every day. I'm sure it happens to you. We cover stories knowing it's not gonna get views,
right?
It's not gonna make any money, but we feel a responsibility to talk about these things. But you do still have to make money. Mm-hmm. And it's terrible that that even enters into it at all. And this is, I think, one of like the worst examples of that.
You want to plug my Patreon now?
I want to. You can plug anything you want. We have 30 seconds.
No, I'm just playing. I just thought it was.
No, but really, we do appreciate you coming on.
Patreon.com/TMBS. Check out the Michael Brooks Show.
Check it out, Michael Brooks Show, No Filter,
yes,
as well, and the Young Turks, of course. Everybody yes. knows that. But No Filter, a very popular podcast, is awesome.
Thank you.
Yes.
And thank you again for coming in. Great to have you here. Hopefully, we'll see you again soon. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.